This is Rhino Geo calling from the WWFM 3 flash mob in Melbourne. And
in this episode of GeoTalk, we speak to one of the founding members of geocaching in Australia, Emby from Melbourne. We find out a bit about green burial sites in northern New South Wales, and we celebrate a couple of milestones. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 29 of GeoTalk. Thank you once again for joining me on this podcast. First of all, the GeoTalk GeoCoins have arrived, and I've already had quite a few orders. I think about a quarter of them are already gone. So there are 200 that are up for sale. So go to the website at www.geotalkpodcast.com, and you can fill in an order using a credit card, or you can use a Paymate account. No, not PayPal, but Paymate. Now, if you wanted to win a GeoTalk GeoCoin, you've only got about a day or two left, because this is coming out on the 27th of May. And as you know, there's a competition, if you've been listening for the last two episodes, a competition to win a GeoTalk GeoCoin. And all you have to do is go to the iTunes store, the Australian iTunes store, and leave a comment in the iTunes store. Doesn't matter what sort of comment it is. It could be one star, two star, or preferably five stars. And I'll put you into the draw to see if you can win that coin. Thank you very much to those who have already left a comment. And just a tip for those who aren't in Australia, I might give away another coin or two for those outside the country sometime next month. So you might want to get in a bit early. So that runs until the 31st of May, and the Australian winner of the GeoCoin will be announced in episode number 30. A bit of a milestone announcement. Now, I reached my 1,000th cache the other day, and that's quite an achievement. I'm pretty proud of it. It almost took me 5 years to get there, and I know that's a lot longer than some people, although I have beaten a few others. It seems as though those of us who started a little bit earlier in geocaching, back sort of, you know, between 2000 and maybe 2003, 2004, we seem to take a little bit longer to find our caches. Maybe the enthusiasm is waning. Or maybe we're just a bit more fussy and a bit more particular in the caches we find. I'd be interested to hear from any of you on your thoughts about whether you're a little bit fussy in the caches you choose, whether, you know, getting to a milestone as quick as you can is important, and whether you save important ones for your milestones. Well, I was fortunate enough in that I took the opportunity last weekend to go down to Canberra. I was given a leave pass and went down with Alpini, who's my geocaching friend here in Sydney, from originally from Germany. And we did a maintenance run on Canberra's horizon. And while we were down there, we decided to find my 1,000th cache. And here's some audio from it.
Well, here on a nice Sunday morning, sitting on the Rock of Gibraltar, or Gibraltar Rocks, whatever you like to call it, down in the Tibbinbilla Valley, just outside of Canberra in the Capital Territory. And guess what? I've reached 1,000 finds. Yay! What a milestone. And here joining me on this fantastic, momentous occasion for Spin Doc Bob is Uli from Germany. Thanks for coming along. What did you think of the walk?
The walk was quite steep as yesterday. Not as long, but first of all, congratulations for Millennium Cache, and hope to do some lots of more milestones with you in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too. It's been fantastic, and you're always great to go walking with, because there's always great stories. and you certainly challenged me fitness wise, because you're a lot fitter than I am.
Oh, really.
Although this morning I must say Uli was a little bit slower. Yeah. After yesterday's walk. Yesterday we did some a maintenance trip up to Canberra's Horizon, which is I think I mentioned in an earlier episode, the most unloved geocache in the ACT. Well, no longer, because a group of three geocaches joined Uli and myself. And that was Peter, who also known as McFan, Paul, M-Trax, and Nigel, Two Leg Drive. And they came along, and we had snow, we had wind, we had icy rain belting us during most of it. And a lot of people would say we were insane for going up there, but after 3.5 years, the cache was still there. It's been replaced. And later in the day, we got back. It turned out to be about an 8.5 hour hike in the end, so it might put a few local caches off finding it. But hopefully there'll be a few more in the future. But here we are this morning. We found Gibraltar Rocks, and we've got a great view of the Tibimbilla Valley. We can see the Tibimbilla Space Tracking Station off in the mid-foreground, and then behind that is Canberra with Telstra Tower and all its sights. So if you're ever coming down to the ACT and you want a challenging cache, if you're really mad, you can try Canberra's Horizon. Otherwise, if you feel like just giving the legs a bit of a workout, this one here, the Rock of Gibraltar by Secret Squirrel, down in Canberra, is well worth doing. Well, that's it. We're going to pack up, head back down, and then slowly make our way back to Sydney. Anyway, back to the studio.
So there you go, cache find number 1,000. Certainly was worth doing. Now, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the day before we did some maintenance on Canberra's Horizon, and that was listed as the most unloved geocache in the ACT. Well, that record, it does have no longer. It's now been found. In fact, I took four other geocaches along with me. Alpini, who I mentioned earlier. There was M-Trax and McFan, who are local Canberra geocaches. And also the person who helped introduce me to geocaching, Two Leg Drive. And before I go any further, congratulations, Nigel, to both yourself and Leanne, who had a baby boy just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, Aiden Jauncey. And hopefully he might encourage you to do a bit more geocaching. I know you've been busy over the last few months and haven't been getting out there as much. Another milestone, and it's another baby announcement. Sunny and Sandy, who are the hosts of the Podcacher podcast, they have a baby boy, Sean. So it's S-cubed now down in San Diego. Sunny, Sandy, and Sean. Sunny and Sandy were very fortunate enough to have adopted young Sean from LA, and now he's with them living in San Diego. So congratulations to the two of you and all the best, and we look forward to reading about your geocaching adventures in the near future. On the topic of Podcacher, I've been going back through a few past episodes and listening to some of the tips and tricks and tools of the trade that they dish out. And one of the really interesting things, and this is something for all you Garmin 60 users and for some other Garmin users as well, they have a link to how to customize the icons on your GPS. Because when I've uploaded geocaches using GSAC, I've usually put a little note on the end. I use the GC code as the name of the cache, and then a little code on the end, like a T for traditional or M for multi, V for virtual, and so forth. But this one actually shows you how to use the icons instead. And so you can have little sort of green treasure boxes or yellow ones for multis and little ghosts for virtuals and so forth. I'm going to give you a link in the show notes to that. So go to geotalkpodcast.com and you can find out how to customize your Garmin GPS. And I'd certainly be interested to see if anyone's got any other tips, particularly for Magellan users, on how you might be able to customize your icons there. And don't forget, if you've got any tips or tricks that you'd like to share, particularly for those of us down under, drop us an email at geotalk@mac.com, or you can call it in on the geocaching hotline on 02-800-50-463. I nearly said 436. 463. So that's 850-GEO. And finally, before we get into the GeoTalk profile, the trivia question for this particular episode. And thanks to Caught at Work, here's a little bit of theme music for the GeoTalk Trivia Challenge. Okay, so the question for this particular episode is, which Australian geocacher has had the most consecutive days geocaching? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, on this episode of GeoTalk, we're speaking to one of the original geocachers down in Victoria and the first approver in Australia. His name is Mark, but you might know him as Emby. Welcome to GeoTalk.
Thank you.
So, Mark, tell us, first of all, when did you start getting into geocaching? And also, I don't know the answer to this question, how did you get your name?
Well, it was about late 2001 that I got into geocaching. The name's been around for many, many years. I used to use it. A friend of mine, who's actually now a police officer, he and I had dreams of being detectives one day when we were about sort of 13, 14, 15. And it came up from our surnames Mine was England, his was McConnell, and it was the England McConnell Bureau of Investigation, shortened down to EMBI, and I've just used it ever since.
That's very good. Now, you mentioned that you started in 2001. Back then, geocaching was in its infancy. It would have only been, what, about a year old or so. How many geocaches were there in Victoria at the time?
I reckon there probably would have been no more than about a dozen, three very close to where I was in Ballarat, and the next closest was about halfway to Melbourne.
And were the style of caches back then, I mean, were they all ammo cans, as what some people think they were?
No, the first cache we ever found was in a plastic pipe, and the other three were in a bit larger containers, like sort of a bit containers similar to Sistema, but obviously not with the click shut locks that they have these days. So yeah.
And do any of those still survive?
There is, I think, three of them survive. One of them is in its second reincarnation, and the first one we found actually was placed by a guy who never found a cache. He placed the cache, and I've never heard from him since. But he was an ambulance officer in Ballarat. I remember when I found it, I had his phone number on there, and I rang him and said, you know, I found your cache, thinking that's what you did. And he sort of said, yeah, no worries, whatever. And that was, yeah, the last I heard from him.
How did you find out about geocaching in the first place?
It was, I was needing to buy a new mobile phone, and I went and bought the phone, and it was quite high technology back then, and I was able to get onto the internet, but it was I think it was with Optus, and it was their basic web browser or whatever they had with the phone. And I clicked on website of the day, and it happened to be geocaching, and it was pretty much text-based sort of browser. And I thought, this sounds interesting. So when I got home, I Googled it and looked up about it, and I thought, this is what I want to do. And the next day I went and bought a GPS because I always wanted a GPS but had no reason for getting one, and went and bought it, and the rest is history.
And from that moment on, did you become addicted to geocaching? I mean, how often did you go geocaching back in 2001?
Back then, we went every time there was a cache come up. We went and found it, and we used to have the yellow e-trex, so we had no mapping whatsoever back then. And I remember being able to sit watching the site and go to the last approved cache, and you just add one digit to the end of the URL, and you're able to see the caches that hadn't been reviewed. So I'd sit there at night after work and just every 10 minutes or so keep adding one, and you know, every sort of two or three days, actually probably more than that, you'd see one come up, and so it was the race off to get it. And I remember travelling at the time. I was living in Echuca on the border, and I remember travelling from there to find caches in Ballarat in the middle of the night to try and get them before they were reviewed, but never had a chance to get there. By the time I got home, it had always been reviewed.
So, I mean, you're talking about a couple of hours' drive to get just a first to find.
Yeah, that's what we used to do. And because we had sort of no idea where they were, you'd just sort of head off and try and guess where you were going. So sometimes, I remember one that we spent about 2 or 3 hours just trying to find where to get to it. So, yeah, it was quite interesting. We almost gave up. We kept coming up to dead ends, but we eventually found it. So.
Now, early on in the piece, you became an approver, the first Australian approver. I mean, before we get to that point, who was approving caches in Australia at the time?
Originally, it was the guys in America who were approving them. Mm-hmm. And I think it was in New Zealand. There was they needed, or the people who ran the parks and stuff like that wanted to have a local approver. So they put on a New Zealand approver and said to him, well, you're close to Australia. Let's get you to do those ones. And he was doing that, and I think there was a bit of people upset that there wasn't a New Zealander doing the Australian caches. So because I was in the forums a lot back then and on the chat rooms that they used to have, they were looking for an Australian, and most people knew me, so they approached me and asked me if I'd do it.
And when did that occur? When did you become an approver?
It was about, I'd actually just received from Groundspeak a 5-year service award about a month ago, so about 5 years ago.
Now, obviously, family got in the way and took you out of geocaching. Tell us a little bit about your family.
I've got my wife, Jeanette, and our daughter, Grace, who's been with us for about just under 18 months. When I first met Jeanette, we sort of did a bit of caching, but other interests got us. And then Grace came along and we were building a house and just, you know, you sort of have other priorities at the time, but now we're starting to get back into it again.
What is drawing you back towards it?
I think now that Grace is a bit older and walking and stuff like that and starting to get interested in it, when we went to Tasmania with some of the Victorian group about 2 months ago, we sort of, because we were travelling around, sort of visited a few caches as we drove around and sort of noticed Grace being interested in it. And then the Shepparton event recently, we were able to take her to a few caches, and every time we'd pull a container out of the bush or whatever, her eyes would light up, she'd go, ooh, and then she'd be racing over there to grab something out of it. So for me, it's sort of that excitement of the, I suppose when I first started, you know, finding the container, seeing it in her. So we sort of thought, well, you know, she's interested in it, let's do it.
What have you noticed are the biggest changes in geocaching since when you first did it in 2001 and now that you're back in it in 2008?
There's certainly a lot more out there. We've got thousands that we haven't found around us that we've got plenty of opportunities to go and find. I think also, for me, I've noticed there's probably a lot more micros, which is when I first started, I suppose most of them were sort of out in the bush and stuff like that, so they were quite bigger. But there is definitely a lot more smaller caches. There's a lot more difficult hides, I suppose, especially some of the country ones around Shepparton. I haven't done the Bendigo ones, but the ones in Shepparton are quite inspiring how they hide them. So it's I think there's some things that have gone downhill with it, but also I think there's some better things with it as well.
And as an approver, getting back into approving caches, what differences have you found and what challenges are there in approving caches now as compared to back then?
When I first started, it was very manual as far as how it was done. I remember I would have to, like, I'd look at a cache. I'd basically see what everyone else would see on their cache page. I used to have to cut and paste the coordinates into my own mapping program. And then I had to keep saving everyone's coordinates, so not to see where they were. I don't think we had a saturation rule back then. Because there just wasn't that many around, so you never sort of, they weren't on top of each other as much as what they can be now. But it was very manual. It used to take probably 5 to 10 minutes to look at a cache and make sure that it wasn't, you know, against the rules or anything like that. But these days it's a lot easier in a sense because they've made it more easy to be able to look at a cache and see what's near it, and there's a few different tests that you can just push a button and have information come up to you so you can see it. But also, on the other hand, it can be a bit harder, especially New South Wales with national parks and stuff like that. We have to make sure they're not in parks and things like that. So I think it's got some better things about it, but it's also you have to be a bit more careful with making sure you get things right.
Do you find that there's also a difference in the way that people go geocaching? Because I've noticed since I started in 2003 that it's much more of a group activity than an individual activity. Are you finding the same down in Victoria?
Yeah, I think so. We tend to try and latch onto a group that, you know, or another caching team that might be going out. Definitely, I mean, I suppose there's more groups around, but back then when I first started, there was sort of, especially being in country Victoria, Pyrenees Kid and I would sort of set caches for each other at the time because we were probably the only ones out there, and I'd place one and he'd go off and do it, and he'd place one and I'd go off and do it. So nowadays there's sort of more out there, and you tend to, I suppose, go out for the day. So it's good to have another group with you and head out together.
So, Mark, tell me, do you have any goals that you want to achieve before the end of the year?
I think for me it's just getting the cache numbers up a bit. Not that I'm in it for the numbers, but being in it since 2001, nearly it's coming up to 7 years actually, and we've still only found about 350, and there's so many more out there that I have probably over the years published and sort of thought that'd be a good cache to find and never done it. In fact, just last weekend I found one that I've always wanted to do, and I remember reviewing it years ago, and so it's good to knock some of those off.
Now, you encountered Macamob, who these days I think are about the second highest finders in Australia. Tell us a little bit about when you met the two of them.
I remember meeting Macamob in Ballarat one weekend, and we were sitting in a cafe, and they had their book of caches that they collect, keep all their records of the caches that they've found. And I'd been in it for a few years, and I remember sitting down with them. I'd probably had about 60 caches at the time that I'd found, and they'd been in it for about 3 weeks, and they'd done about 50. And I remember sitting there thinking, man, these guys are going at it flat out. And the rest is history. They've definitely found quite a few caches, way past what I've found.
I think at last count, they were up to about 4,500.
Yeah, that's right.
So
I've probably got about 2,600 in Victoria. If I looked at GSAC, I reckon it's how many that are in Victoria that I need to find to just find the ones in Victoria.
Well, listen, thanks very much for chatting to us, Mark, also known as MB, and hopefully you'll get to that target, and hopefully Grace will find many more geocaches for you in the near future.
Excellent. No worries. Thanks.
Well, on GeoTalk now, we've got a story that's a little bit offbeat, but it involves GPS, and it's here in Australia. And I'm joined by Chris Whitney, who's from the Lismore Council. Thanks for chatting with us.
How are you, Darren? Not a problem, mate.
Now, this is interesting. It's popped up in a few media places around the place. It's about burials in a nature area and using GPS to plot where those burial plots are. Can you tell me a little bit more about it and explain to the listeners what it's all about?
All right. Well, probably in the context of burials, this kind of cemetery format or layout is very different. There's currently a good one down in Tasmania near Launceston, but we've probably got the first one on the east coast of Australia. And basically what it is, it's what they refer to as green burial or natural burial. It's where basically there's a piece of redeveloped bushland, a bit of regenerated scrubland that's come back on its own. And we actually use that as a cemetery interment site rather than go and clear fell all the trees, form it up with headstones and nice turf rows and all those kinds of things. We actually go the complete reverse and just leave it as it is, as scrub land, and we actually inter people in burial plots in that land. And the sort of how the GPS got involved in it, there are some others in the USA who refer to the fact that they use GPS to indicate to people where these grave locations are, because otherwise if they don't use a conventional headstone on the grave, there's no way of indicating where the grave site is. So actually plot these things out very accurately and then give the GPS coordinates to people who can come in on the weekend, you know, or they can put it on a website somewhere, put it on a public register, and anybody can find your grave somewhere off in the future when they want to come through the area and have a look.
Now, the other way in which it differs from I suppose, what you would class as a conventional gravesite is that the headstones are made from natural rocks and the burials are actually done using biodegradable materials. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Yeah, the green burial or natural earth burial concept prefers you don't use a coffin. A lot of these burials take place where the body is simply wrapped in a cotton shroud or some other biodegradable material shroud. But some others use either recycled cardboard coffins. Some use, especially in the UK, they use woven wicker coffins, which are beautiful devices. And any of those sort of more biodegradable coffin-type materials. Conventional coffins, You know, they have a nice glossy shellac coating and such forth. They're actually just a veneer coating. Underneath that is a piece of MDF timber full of formaldehyde and all kinds of other nasties that we don't want to introduce into this environment. So we demand that they are natural organic materials that we put into this site.
So why did the council decide to set up this this type of environmentally friendly cemetery?
Well, basically we had an area of land that we couldn't develop as a conventional cemetery due to the slope, the depth of the land, the fact that it was this area was full of old, mature eucalypt trees, which were intended when the state government gave the council the land to manage back in the 60s or so, they said, you know, we could use the land for the cemetery. But since that time, of course, different legislation comes on. There are now much higher constraints as to what you can use your land for, whether you can take trees out or not. And we happen to be in a primary habitat area for koalas. So the gum trees couldn't come out. So we thought, well, what are the methods are people using worldwide to utilise land? It's a little bit difficult. And the green burial concept fitted perfectly.
What sort of people do you expect to be buried in this area? And is it going to be available to people outside the council or just for local residents?
No, it's certainly not local. I've actually had two inquiries of people who are very interested, and they're both from Sydney at this point in time. But it's not only going to be the hippie greenie types. It'll be anybody who really doesn't like the fact that they're going to use more earthly resources just to be buried. When their time comes on the planet, some people would prefer to slip out as quietly and comfortably as they possibly can to the planet. They don't want to consume any more resources. So the biodegradable type green burial concept fits perfectly and dovetails with that ideals quite well.
Mm. And when is the cemetery expected to open?
1st of July is our intended date of opening, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning you're not the first one in Australia. There are others around the country in Tasmania, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, there's an excellent one in Launceston, I think, in Tasmania. They've really adopted the green burial concept very well. There are a few other cemeteries amongst Australia. There's actually another good one in South Australia and Western Australia as well. But there are a few cemeteries who might have the bushland word somewhere in the name. But basically, a few gum trees in amongst the manicured lawn doesn't quite to the green burial concept. No.
And have you had interest from other councils who want to find out a bit more about what you're doing and replicate it in their area?
Not from local government, no. No, but I've had quite a lot of interest from media, both Australia and international media at this point in time. Other local governments, I believe, will take it on. It's just sort of a slow-moving trend in Australia.
Mm.
It's well-developed in the western states of America, California and such forth, and it's also very well-developed in the UK right now.
Well, it's a very interesting project and all the best with it, and who knows, you might have geocachers in the future who, when they're looking at putting their last final cache, I suppose, on the earth, that they might come up your way.
I think it's quite a nice concept to be able to actually use your headstone as a geocache.
As long as they're not looking for any buried treasure, I hope not. Look, thanks very much, Chris, for joining us on GeoTalk.
Thank you, Darren.
Okay, very quickly, a bit of a roundup of some of the events that are occurring around the country. We haven't done this for a few weeks. On the 1st of June, there is Where's K8 over in Brisbane, and down near Wollongong is Thurl by the Sea. I'm sorry, I'm not a local. I'm going to muck that one up. But those two events are on the 1st of June. On the long weekend, the Queen's Birthday long weekend, on the 6th is Mulled on the Mountain, version number 2. That's being held just north of Beaufort in the Ballarat district. That's an area I went to university in. On the 7th of June is the Geocaching Dinner over in Cadell. I think that's just north of Adelaide. And on the 8th of June, there is the Cozy Corner Caching at Waikaree, which is north of Adelaide. There is the Catherine Region Mid-Year event. I'd love to go to that event. I might have to book myself in for next year on that one, up in the Northern Territory out near Darwin. And the first ever traditional annual Northwest Tasmania barbecue hosted just south of Burnie. I think the Cheesy Pigs helped stir up a bit of action there up in northwestern Tasmania. If you want to find out more about those events, check out the show notes at geotalkpodcast.com. And if you want to promote your event, don't forget, just give us a call on 850-GEO. Well, I'm running well over time once again, and so I'm going to have to move another article that I wanted to run in this particular one on the Nokia N95 and how you can use that geocaching along with Geocache Navigator. I'm going to have to hold that off to the next episode. But quickly, just a correction on the last episode where I talked about the Where I Go cache. I said it was in Perth, and I knew as soon as I posted it up on the web I was wrong. Mr. Emu got in touch with me, and hi to Mr. Emu. We bumped into each other back in May last year, this time last year actually, while we were out geocaching. Mr. Emu set it up in Geelong, and he set up the Where I Go cache down there. Now, he gives me a bit of detail about how you can use the Where I Go without actually using the Colorado or without a mobile Windows mobile device. But the catch is you do have to be running Windows, and as most people know, I'm a Mac user. But one of the things he points out is that he likes the idea of Where I Go because on the plus side, it might allow multi-stage tours of national parks, which obviously is an issue in New South Wales, not so much in the other states. And will allow you to go through a park and maybe find the cache outside of the park's boundary. And he also suggests it's a better way than setting up, say, just a virtual or a Waymarks. And, of course, you get a smiley at the end of it. So that's the email for this particular episode. If you've got an email you want to drop in, a suggestion, a comment, criticism, brickbat, bouquets, whatever you've got to say, geotalk@mac.com, or you can phone it in on 02-850-GEO. Well, there's only one thing left to do before we get to the end of the podcast, and that is reveal the answer to the trivia question, which for this particular episode is which geocacher has the most number of consecutive days with a find. Now, according to the Geocaching Wiki, the winner of this esteemed title is Flipper & Co. with 140 days. Now, according to that wiki, that's up until the 19th of March. Now, I was prompted to ask this question because I got a voicemail from Flipper, and here's a little bit of it.
Mark Hamilton from Flipper & Co. We're about to achieve 200 days in a row. We started the 1st of November last year and we're still going.
So hopefully in the next episode we might hear from Flipper & Co. and find out whether they've stretched that 140 days any further. Well, that's all for this particular episode of GeoTalk. Thanks very much for joining us. In the next episode, we will get around to the Nokia N95 and Geocache Navigator, and we might have a chat to Flipper & Co. with any luck. Until next time, safe geocaching.